The Vintage Gamer, Episode 13, A Choir.
This show is a member of Goblin, the gaming broadcast network, gbncom.com.
Hello, and welcome to The Vintage Gamer, the podcast that seeks out great games from an earlier era. I'm your host, Jim Van Verth. The Vintage Gamer is a podcast available via RSS or direct download at www.thevintagegamer.net. So, yeah, episode 13. What's up with that? Well, I realized that I should have numbered the two GDC reports, number 9 and 10, and so the last two podcasts should have been 11 and 12. So, this one becomes episode 13. I'll probably go through and renumber them later. But for now, I'm just going to restart the numbering and proceed from there. And if you happen to be listening after I did that, hopefully you're not confused. Let's see. Some other podcasts have been covering vintage games lately. First of all Games Considered did an in-depth discussion of game books on their first anniversary show. For those who aren't familiar with them or are too lazy to follow the link in the show notes, they are an intermediate stage, that is, the game books are an intermediate stage between choose-your-own-adventure books and paragraph-based games like Barbarian Prince. All Games Considered is not an intermediate stage. They're a podcast that covers role-playing games and sometimes board and card games. Secondly, a relatively new podcast, the Godzilla Gaming Podcast, recently covered an old RPG, 2300 AD, also known in the original printing as Traveler 2300. They've also covered James Bond 007, which may be of interest to Top Secret fans, so you might want to go check those guys out. They broadcast from Japan and talk about RPGs primarily. Finally, I should have mentioned this a while ago, and you've probably heard about it from other podcasts and blogs, but Palladium Books, publishers of the Rifts and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles RPGs, has run into some financial troubles and could use your help getting back on their feet. You can get more information on their situation at www.palladium.com, and you can also find out how you can help out there. And that's about it for news, so after a brief break, we'll get to the game.
Firepoint Media, in conjunction with DragonCon, America's largest multimedia popular arts convention, presents Podcasting Now and Beyond, a celebration of portable media programming bringing together the full spectrum of podcasters and their audience, from pros to first-timers, for a conference of information and entertainment. Join us for panels, seminars, workshops, and events culminating in the Parsec Awards, honoring podcasting excellence and speculative fiction. Visit our website at www.parsecawards.com to join us in podcasting history. Podcasting Now and Beyond, September 1st through 4th at the DragonCon Convention in Atlanta, Georgia. Your future to the power of beyond.
In 1902, a company called Minnesota Mining and Manufacturing, or 3M for short, was founded. One of its early innovations was the creation of waterproof sandpaper, and the search for other suitable adhesives led to the creation of masking tape, and then scotch tape. They were also one of the market leaders in recording tape for similar reasons. Today there is still a market force, and every office would collapse without, or perhaps under, one of their modern creations, the Post-it note. Now that's all very lovely, but this podcast is about games. Well, in 1962, 3M broke out of their standard chemical and manufacturing vein and started to produce games. Their first line was known as the 3M Bookshelf Games and was directed primarily at adults, as opposed to the children and family games produced by such companies as Parker Brothers and Milton Bradley. It contained such classics as Twixt and Sleuth, as well as slick versions of Go, Backgammon, Mancala, and chess. But one of the earliest was A Choir, designed by one of the masters of American board games, Sid Sackson. I already covered Mr. Saxon's game Can't Stop in podcast number 6, and really it was only a matter of time before I got to this one. The theme of Acquire, as you might guess from the name, is mergers and acquisitions of companies. In the original game, you are building, expanding, and merging chains of hotels, as well as buying and selling stock in each of the chains. When two chains merge, the smaller chain is absorbed by the larger one. This leads to payouts for the stockholders in the smaller chain, and eventually no chains can be taken over, the game ends, and all stock pays off. The winner is the one with the most money. Pretty simple. And that's really all there is to it. Within that simple concept, and as you'll see, simple design, comes a complex and nerve-wracking game of difficult decisions. Now to the details of gameplay. The game is played on a board consisting of a 12x9 grid with a letter and number code in each square, like A9. The numbers run left to right and the letters top to bottom. For each square, there's one similarly numbered tile. These represent the hotels in each chain. At the beginning of the game, each player draws one tile and places it on the board to seed the hotels. In addition, the player with the tile closest to the upper left-hand corner, or A1, starts. After that, each player gets $6,000 of seed money and a hand of 5 tiles. Now, you do 3 things on your turn. The first is to build a hotel by placing 1 tile. If this creates a block of 2 or more hotels, connected either horizontally or vertically, a hotel chain is formed. This is indicated by placing a marker on top of the tiles. In the original game, the marker is rather simple, just a colored tile with a letter on it, the first letter of the particular chain. In the later printings, these markers are more complex, either little buildings in the case of the latest Avalon Hill version, or gaudy signs in the case of the Schmidt Spiele version. Associated with each chain is a certain number of stock cards. As the founder of a chain, you get 1 free stock card for that chain, and you can buy more later in your turn. The value of the stock goes up as the chain grows, which happens by either adding tiles or merging with other chains, so clearly you want to get in early, and that free card is a big bonus. Now, merging occurs when a tile is placed that would connect 2 hotel chains. The tiles of the smaller chain, known as the defunct chain, become part of the larger one, and the smaller chain ceases to exist. At this point, there is a payoff to stockholders in the defunct chain. The person who owns the most stock in the chain, or the majority stockholder, receives a large bonus in cash. The person with the second most stock in the company, also known as the minority stockholder, gets a bonus of half that amount. If 2 or more people have the largest amount of stock, then they split both the majority and minority take, and the rest get nothing. If 1 person has the majority, and there is a tie for the minority, then the minority folks divvy up the minority take. The best possible result for someone is if no one else has stock in the chain. Then they get both the majority and minority payoffs, all to themselves. And that actually happened in one of the games that we played. Finally, all stockholders, starting with the person who merged the 2 chains and going around clockwise, have a chance to do 1 of 3 things. First, they could sell their stock in the company at the current face value. Secondly, they could trade their defunct stock for stock in the new parent company at a 2-to-1 margin. That is, 2 defunct stock for 1 parent stock. Third, they could hold on to their stock in the hopes that the company will rise again. And they, of course, could do combinations of that, say, sell 2 stock, trade in another 2, and hold on to a remaining 1. Note that a company with 2 tiles will not generate as much income when merged as would a company of 3 tiles, or especially 10 tiles. Also, some companies have larger value than others. Luxor and Tower, from the original game, give a majority bonus of $2,000 and a share value of $200 for 2 tiles. Whereas America, Festival, and Worldwide give a majority bonus of $3,000 and a share value of $300. And Imperial and Continental return $4,000 and $400, respectively. So, as you can see, picking the right companies and the right size companies to merge can make a big difference on the sort of return you can expect. There are a couple of additional rules for merging. First, 2 companies of the same size can be merged. The player who places the merging tile gets to choose which one goes away and which one stays. Secondly, there is 1 restriction on merging. A company of 11 or more tiles is considered safe, and so can't be acquired. However, such a company can still take over other smaller companies. Now, if there are two companies of 11 or greater that are separated by one tile, that tile is no longer valid, and it can't be placed because the two companies can't be merged. So at the end of your turn, you can discard that tile, as well as placing the original tile that you placed. So all that excitement happens, or can happen, in the first part of a person's turn. After that, it's pretty uneventful. In the second part of their turn, a player can buy up to three stock cards. They can be three different stocks, or all the same, but the number shall be no more than three. Five is right out. Sorry. Finally, the player draws a new tile, or possibly more than that, if they had to discard tiles, to refresh their hand up to five. And that's the turn. The game ends when all the hotel chains are safe, or there is one hotel chain with 41 hotels. At this point, all remaining stock is cashed out, just like you'd cash out during a merger, and the winner is the one with the most money. As with any game, there are a few variant rules floating out there. The main one included with the current, or rather the newest, Avalon Hill version, is whether you play with your stock cards and money revealed, or whether you play with them hidden. Playing with them hidden leads to more deceit and trickery in buying stock, under the assumption that the other players won't remember what cards you have in your hand. Now, another interesting variant removes the randomness from the tile draw by placing the tiles upside down on top of the board in their appropriate places. So instead of drawing randomly from a pile, you're going to reach out on the board and pick the particular one you need. Now, of course, this means that the other players know which tiles you have, assuming, again, that they can remember. Finally, apparently at one point, Avalon Hill added a variant where each player has special powers that allow them to break the rules of the game. But frankly, I can't see playing it that way, as it would break the delicate balance of a wonderfully tuned game. Now, as I've sort of alluded to, Acquire has gone through a number of additions through the years. As mentioned, Acquire was originally published by 3M, and in its first printing had very handsome wooden tiles. However, these were quickly replaced by the more economical plastic tiles. Also, in the original printing, there was no different pricing for each stock, but increasing numbers of available cards instead. Some initial stock cards were dealt out to each player. There was no free stock card for founding a hotel chain, and you could only buy one stock card per turn. These rules are available online, and I will, of course, include a link in the show notes. Now, I've mentioned Avalon Hill a couple times. What happened was that in 1976, 3M decided to get out of the games business and sold the rights to their games to Avalon Hill, with the understanding that they would be reprinted with the same quality as before. Because of this, the components and theme of the first Avalon Hill editions are nearly the same as the 3M components. However, later Avalon Hill kind of broke their agreement, and the later editions were much poorer and had a flat board and cardboard tiles. The original board was plastic and had nice recessed areas where you would place the tiles. Once Hasbro acquired Avalon Hill, one of the first games they put out in their new Avalon Hill line was a very nice version of Acquire, and this is the one that I own. They went back to the plastic board and tiles. They sort of reversed the sense of the plastic board. The original board was inset, whereas this one has kind of knobbies that stick out, and you place the tiles over those. And as I mentioned, they also added to it some very nice-looking building markers that indicate which groups of tiles represent which companies. They also changed the theme a bit, from hotel chains to tech companies. This sort of breaks up the somewhat geographical notion that you are expanding hotels along blocks of a city, and then they kind of expand into each other, and that's how the merger occurs. But really, it doesn't affect the gameplay too much, and I suppose it could be argued that it updates the game. One thing that they did when they did this is they changed all the names of the companies, and they added one company called Saxon. I have to agree with one reviewer I found online. They actually named one of the cheaper companies Saxon. I really don't understand why they didn't name one of the more expensive ones Saxon. Anyway. Another edition was published by Schmidt Spiele in 1993, which used cards to represent the tiles. So instead of placing a tile on the board, you place a little colored building piece and discard the card. To represent a chain, a plastic sign is placed on top of a cluster of buildings. Now, I've heard that it's quite attractive, and perhaps it is in person. But from the photos online, it looks a bit gaudy to me. The buildings are brightly colored, transparent plastic. I also don't like the idea of having yet another hand of cards to manage. I rather like the separation between the building tiles, which I can actually place down on the table, and the stock cards, which I can hold in my hand. Unfortunately, at this point, all of these editions are out of print. You can find copies online at eBay and other auction sites, and the prices are usually around $50 for the 3M and early Avalon Hill versions, and much higher for the Schmidt-Spiele and the new Avalon Hill versions. I would just be careful of the cheap Avalon Hill version when you bid. Also, at the time of this recording, you can also get some of the new Avalon Hill versions at ToysRUs.com for $39 and $9 shipping. And no, I don't get a cut. I'm just saying that's the price, which is where I got mine. But once that's gone, I think that's about it for Acquire, unless Watsy / Hasbro decides to publish it again. Very sad. As a wrap-up to the history portion of the show, I should probably give credit where credit is due, and mention that my primary source for this history is from a collection of pages by Bob Claster called The Great Games of Sid Sackson. And again, that link will be in the show notes. I will cover some strategy and have a brief review / session report after this.
All games considered promo, take one. Carol, you max out on charisma while Chris and I play a drop of Nelson's blood.
Wait, what's this in the script about a Monty Python ripoff?
Mark, haven't these been done already?
Well, we need some kind of gimmick.
We don't need a gimmick. We just need to tell people that All Games Considered is a podcast about tabletop gaming, gamers...
and gamer culture.
Gamer culture.
Just go with it.
Yeah, we talk about board games, role-playing games, ways to improve your game. Might even help you save a little cash with cheap gaming tips.
And other little-known games people may want to try.
And we can always point out neat conventions to go to.
Good. Keep going.
And I suppose they can find that information along with the RSS feeds, Frapper map and forum links, and show notes on allgamesconsidered.blogspot.com.
And?
We're part of PEN's Gaming Podcast Network and Goblin, the Gaming Broadcast Network.
Right, but how do we work the Mythic Heroes journey into that?
Never mind. Just listen to the show.
I can't claim to be an expert on Acquire, as I've only played against humans twice, and against a few different types of computer opponents a handful of times, but here goes. Strategy for Acquire is pretty fluid because of two non-deterministic elements. The first is the random draw of tiles. Since you don't know what you're going to get, there's no way to plan a grand strategy around them. The other is the play of the other players. You can have some inkling of what they're up to based on their actions. For example, if they're buying up one type of stock, you might think that they're about to make a move there. But you can never be sure that they won't merge two companies at the worst possible time for you, or expand a company that you're trying to keep small, and so on. Despite that, there are some fairly clear guidelines. Your early goal is to buy majorities in small chains at low stock prices, and then grow them and merge them into larger chains, so as to get the greatest return. Since some chains inherently have larger value, you're going to want to get stock in those companies first. So one first step towards that seems to be the one to form expensive chains early, so you can get that one piece of stock free. One possibility after that might be to buy a large hunk of shares to get an early majority in that company, but that may backfire as you're spending more money to get possibly a small return. Alternatively, you can diversify by buying shares in other companies. This allows you to possibly sneak in a majority or minority in another company, and protects you if another player tries a hostile takeover, i.e. if you lose your majority or majorities, you have something to back you up. The other advantage of diversifying, I've sort of already alluded to, is when you're playing with closed hands, i.e. each player's hand of stock is hidden. It's harder for the other players to remember which stocks you have if you buy three cards of different stocks, as opposed to buying a big block of one stock. Now, this strategy doesn't work when you're playing against the computer versions, but something to keep in mind when you're playing against human opponents. A key decision comes when a merger occurs. Do you sell your stock or keep it? The WOTC site for Acquire suggests cases where you'll want to trade. For example, if the value of the surviving stock is more than the value of the stock you'd be trading in. As far as keeping stock, there seems to be two suggestions. One is if you have a small amount of stock in the defunct company, i.e. not enough to trade or sell, and you hope you can sneak in a majority when the company is refounded. Another possibility is if the defunct company is two or three tiles, and you have a tile in your hand that can refound the company yourself. With the free tile, that would give a handsome majority, and you have no money spent, and you're not going to gain much by cashing in on the two tiles. In any case, if you're short of cash, it's usually best to sell at least some of the stock so you have money to buy new stocks with, which is a very important part of the game. When you're cash poor and the other people are cash rich, you're in big trouble. Finally, a general rule of thumb is that early in the game you want money, so you can buy more stock, and late in the game you want stock, so you can try to tie up majorities in the safe chains that form. As they'll be quite large, those will pay off quite well and can turn the tide of the game. As mentioned, there are more strategy tips available on the WOTC site for Acquire. And yes, check the show notes. I have to admit that when I first saw pictures of Acquire, it looked pretty dry. I mean, come on, it's a board of numbered tiles, a pack of stock cards, and some money. Well, I first played this a week ago at game night, and we were all pleasantly surprised at how fun it was. In fact, based on the look of it and the theme, we nearly didn't play it. The only incentive was that I had just gotten it and wanted to try it out. Well, it went over great. One of the best responses to a game in a while. We liked it enough that we played it this week as well. I liked it enough that I dashed out this podcast. I mean, hey, I promised no 80s board games. This one is from the 60s. Both games were rather different. The first game, we ended up with a few medium-sized corporations, and the game ended because all the corporations were safe. Also, everyone had pretty much the same amount of money, around $22,000 to $25,000. In the game we just played, we ended up with one giant mega corporation, which was one of the higher paying ones, Quantum, for those scoring at home. In this one, two players ended up way ahead of everybody else with cash in the range of $43,000 to $47,000. And my wife beat me by $4,000. Darn it. My strategy in the second game was rather different than the first. Instead of diversifying in a lot of corporations as I did before, I focused on getting majorities in just a few and let the rest go fallow. I also avoided growing and merging the ones I didn't care about. Overall, it worked out. I just needed that one extra card to win. Despite the rather austere components, what makes this game so good? I think a big part of what makes it good is true of a lot of the great German games. You have a lot of things that you want to do, and you can only do very few of them. So you have to choose your actions very, very carefully. This leads to a series of tantalizing and sometimes agonizing decisions. Should you buy that stock in the company that you can expand next turn, or should you shore up your majority? Should you merge in that company, or try to grow it a little bit and hope that no one steals your majority? The other thing I think it has is the right mix of randomness and planning. Your tile draw is random, but with the six tiles in your hand, you usually have something you can do that will advance your cause. And in any case, you can buy stock and try to ride the backs of other players, if it comes down to that. The randomness also keeps the game from getting too dry and predictable. However, the rest of the game is in your hands. If you make poor decisions and don't try to maximize your outcomes, you will lose. Speaking of great German games, I have to believe that Tigris and Euphrates was at least influenced by this game. Tigris and Euphrates has the same tile-laying mechanic, nearly the same sized board, and the same notion of merging two entities together and the side with the larger value winning. In the case of Tigris and Euphrates, the value is measured by the type of conflict and the tiles in your hand, but the general concept is there. Since playing on that first game night, I've tried out a number of computer versions. Unfortunately, the best I've found for Windows is an old DOS version which you can download for BoardGameGeek. I say unfortunate because it is full screen, and so you're pretty much playing it until you're done. Also, it shuts down quickly when the game is over, so it can be hard to tell if you've won. However, it is faithful to the rules, and the AI seems to play pretty well. Other computer versions I've tried are Venture, which is a $10 shareware game, and Get Hostile, a free web-based game with AI support. There's also NetAcquire, which allows human players to play over a LAN or internet, but doesn't have AI support. I haven't tried NetAcquire, since I've been trying once with AI versions, but Venture and Get Hostile are okay. Given the choice, I'd probably go with Get Hostile, although Venture has better graphics. The main problem with both of them is that neither follows the rule for seeding the board before play, so that the first player is at a big disadvantage. This might be to balance out a perceived advantage of the first player in the original game. If that player has the right tile, they can form an expensive chain and nab stock right away. But I think it tips a bit too far the other way, as the first player now has no chance at all of getting stock on their first turn. And in reading this, I actually thought of another possibility that they were thinking of. Maybe they just didn't like the random draw as seeding the game, and they wanted the players to have control over how the game is seeded. I'm not sure. In summary, I highly recommend Acquire. Even with the markups on eBay, it's not that much more expensive than some designer games. And really, it is a great classic. As one reviewer says, with a copy of the stock payout sheet, you could even play it on a dirt floor with a stick if you wanted to. But get a decent copy. I'd say it's worth it. I'll be back with feedback and final thoughts after this.
Thanks for breaking the ice, but I am a gamer. Owning some electronic mind zapper doesn't make you a gamer, so don't take this name from me. I play with pulp, dice, paper, plastic, something you can touch, feel, smell. I am a gamer. Thanks to this mass media insurgence, I must swim into a diluted sea of gaming nomenclature just to make my point. Play games with depth, play games with pulp. My gamer t-shirt doesn't have anything to do with your video addicted brother-in-law. Thanks for breaking the ice, but I am a gamer. PulpGamer.com.
Not a lot of feedback on Fury of Dracula, other than some nice comments from Eric Burgess and the Gnome from Greece. However, Paul Tevis is cursing my name for the Furries of Dracula joke, so I suppose it was worth it. I did also get an anonymous comment on my vocal qualities, and thank you for that. You're going to make my head swell. However, if you have feedback for the Vintage Gamer, you can leave comments on the website, which is, again, www.thevintagegamer.net, or you can contact me directly via email at vintagejim@gmail.com, or via Skype. My username is JVSquare. Feedback is always welcome. And thus concludes yet another cash-heavy episode of The Vintage Gamer. Our theme is performed by the trio Music of the Spheres and available on the album of the same name at magnatune.com. Your humble host is Jim Van Verth. The next episode of The Vintage Gamer will feature the classic Atari game, MULE, or just Mule. Until then, keep trying those new games, but don't forget to play the old ones. Thanks for listening.